Red flag laws are being brought up as a response to the recent slew of mass shootings. Professor Buzz Scher joins me to discuss. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or hosts and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, before we get into all the politics and everything that surrounds it, what are gun violence restraining orders, also known as red flag laws?
Are also known as extreme risk protection orders, ERPOs. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, they are statutes that authorize, in certain circumstances, the police to go in and involuntarily seize somebody's guns. The key, obviously, is what are such circumstances, and there's right. great variation around the country. As a general matter, the concept is let's take guns away from people who are dangerous and who we think will or might or may commit a crime with a gun if they don't take the guns away. And as you can imagine, it's all in that language. What counts as dangerous? How certain do you have to be? Is it okay if a person's just a risk of committing a crime with a gun, or are they are shooting somebody with a gun or shooting themselves with a gun, or do they need to be a threat to do so? The difference between risk assessment and threat assessment. So that's, and there's all sorts of shapes and sizes of ERPO, red flag legislation around the country. Some are very, very simple and don't cover a broad group of people, and right. others are try to cover a very broad group of people.
Because there's 17 states that have already implemented
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Now, there's two fundamental issues. One is how broad is the scope of individuals who may be subject to such laws? That is, who do they define as, it's an odd way to put it, but eligible to be identified as dangerous? Mm-hmm. Then the second issue is, okay, we're going to take guns away from somebody involuntarily. Is there a Fourth Amendment issue? That
yeah.
is it going into their house to take those guns away, an unreasonable search and seizure? And second, what process are they due? Before you take their guns away involuntarily, do they get a hearing? Do they get a lawyer? What standard of proof? Is it probable cause? Is it a preponderance of the evidence? Is it clear and convincing evidence, et cetera? So those two categories of issues, the process that they're due and their Fourth Amendment rights, and then the scope of people that are "quote unquote," possibly eligible.
Plus Second Amendment, fact you're taking away the gun.
The process issue is really a flows out of the fact that you are depriving someone of their constitutional right to possess a gun. That's very certain in New Hampshire, where the New Hampshire Constitution very specifically talks about a constitutional right to possess a gun for self-defense. Mm-hmm. The Second Amendment at the federal level has been interpreted to include that, but also has allowed for all sorts of gun control legislation. You don't have an absolute right to possess a gun no matter what under the Second Amendment. So the way you account for depriving someone of their Second Amendment or New Hampshire constitutional right to possess a gun is you give them due process before you
right.
do it.
Okay. So in theory, they would be told beforehand before.
Well, in theory, not only will they be told beforehand, and again, it depends on the statute. And, mm-hmm. you know, these laws are very new
right.
around the country, so it really hasn't been tested whether at a state level, where we're talking about a state constitutional right to possess a gun, what process is due when you're taking away somebody's gun, as opposed to when you're taking away somebody's freedom, which is another constitutional right.
Right.
Yeah. So how do the process, are you do more process for one than the other? I think most people would say you're do more process if you're going to put somebody in jail. Before you put them in jail, the interesting question that's really just going to start to play out is how much process are you due when you're taking away just the gun? You're not putting them in jail. Mm-hmm. Are you entitled to counsel for the hearing when that decision's being made? What's the standard of proof? Can you call your own witnesses? Can you get the court behind you in issuing subpoenas to call your own witnesses? That kind of thing. Those are the kinds of process you get to cross-examine the witnesses.
Is there anything else that kind of resembles this issue with guns? I mean, with a lot of things, you kind of gain access to things via like a motor vehicle. You got to take a test, but yeah, guns don't work that way necessarily.
It's different with a motor vehicle for an obvious but often not talked about reason. You don't have a constitutional right to own a car.
Mm-hmm.
So it's different when you're taking away somebody's car.
Right.
You know, at a very fundamental level, you don't have a constitutional right to a driver's license. In fact, a driver's license in pretty much every state in this country is a privilege. It's not a right.
Right.
So what about if you're taking away somebody's money?
Yes.
You know, there's a whole body of law of what kind of process you're due, which is different than the process you're due when you take away somebody's freedom. Mm-hmm. As well, it should be. But then again, you know, taking away somebody's property, we have constitutional amendments in New Hampshire and federally relating to eminent domain, which is taking away somebody's property without their consent in order to most frequently, like build a highway. And there's certain procedures you need to go through. They can take it away, like it or not, if they follow the procedures. One of the procedures that is included is you have to pay them a reasonable market value for the property you're taking away. Mm-hmm. So there are not four square analogs, but there are analogs that start to inform you, ranging from taking away somebody's freedom to taking away somebody's money or property. And, you know, taking away somebody's constitutionally entitled right to possess a gun is somewhere in between those two.
Now, something I've heard as a concern regarding these laws are people who put in false claims against a person.
Yeah, I think that's an overblown concern mm-hmm. in that most ERPO statutes, red flag statutes that I've read have explicit language that says if you lie in filing a petition, then you are guilty of a misdemeanor.
Oh, okay. So that was something that's not really been widely circulated I've seen, which you think it should be. I mean, that would be an easy way to write off a lot of the concerns on the right.
And some states, the petition you file, one files, be it a police officer or a layperson, it has to be a sworn affidavit, and it's a crime in that state to lie in a sworn affidavit. So that's a overblown concern. One of the things that's going on right now is a lot of people are talking about a lot of things and they haven't done the research.
Right.
They don't know what's going on out there. Everybody likes the idea many people like the idea of taking guns away from people who are really dangerous. Everyone can sign on to that.
Yeah.
But
what does it mean? What does that
mean?
What is
really, how dangerous? You know, there are some statutes that certainly seem to read like if you were my roommate for 2 years and you were in possession of guns and then I left and started rooming with somebody else. But during the time we were rooming together, you made threats to kill various people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a year later, 6 months later, in some of these statutes, I could go in and get the guns taken away. I could ask the court to have the guns taken away. One, because you possessed the guns, and two, because you were making threats.
Right.
And I am a person of interest and who has knowledge in that area. You know, you can't go in if you've never met me and said, I heard that Buzz has got a lot of guns and he's a little weird. Right? You can't do that. Now, another issue, going back to one of the two issues I identified, the scope of the group. Mm-hmm. One of the real problems is who do we want in that group? And there's a lot of misunderstanding. For example, too many people believe that mentally ill people who possess guns are more dangerous than mentally ill people than the general population, or that mentally ill people generally are more dangerous than the general population. Turns out the opposite is true. The general population is more dangerous than the group of everyone who is diagnosed with a mental illness. But there's the public and the public discourse. Certainly our president and many senators say, oh, this isn't about guns, it's about mental illness. Well, it's not the mentally ill who are the biggest threat in that sense.
Clinically diagnosed mentally ill, assuming you mean.
Number one. Right. Number two, those who are severely mentally ill and are a danger to themselves or another are subject to involuntary emergency admission statutes in any state. So there already is legislation that takes care of the small subsection of the general population of the mentally ill who might be dangerous because they possess guns. So, we have in oh so many different ways stigmatized the mentally ill in this country and many other countries,
right,
for being scary, for being different, for being dangerous, for being not trustworthy, for being unemployable. And this is just another example of that. So you need to be one needs to appreciate when you're thinking about these red flag laws that there already are laws very well developed, constitutionally recognized appropriately, laws out there that allow for people who are severely mentally ill and are a danger to themselves or others to be involuntarily admitted to a state hospital. And by federal law, and therefore state law, they cannot possess guns if that finding is made. So that's one group that's often, and certainly in this latest discussion, oh, it's about mental illness. It's not about mental illness.
Right.
It's not about video games either.
Right.
There's no research out there that says video games causes people to be more violent. I'll just leave it at that. There is no research out there. I could go on forever, but it's not worth doing it. So,
Something I wanted to get into is right now this is state legislation with regards to how its red flag law has been implemented thus
although
far.
Although there's talks federally about
now,
federal.
How would that be handled? Because it's totally different law enforcement perspective.
What I've seen of some of the federal proposals is they want to create a set of standards for state red flag legislation, and then if you follow those standards, you get funding for enforcement.
Oh, okay.
So similar to
speed limits and things like that, be handled very similarly.
Exactly. Now, at the state level, New Hampshire's got a bill pending in the legislature. It was offered up last session, the 2018-2019 legislative session. It was retained by the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee, and it's now it's going to come back this session to see if they can. It was opposed, strongly opposed by many gun groups and strongly supported by a number of individuals. It had a very expansive description of the eligible group, such that if you'd been convicted of a crime in the past, if you'd engaged in violent activity in the past, and you possess guns, you pretty much were in that group. It was a very expansive definition.
Which would be very rough with very libertarian leaning of a lot of people in the states.
Yes. More importantly, there's a fundamental flaw in logic in that. That's a risk assessment type of red flag statute. Mm-hmm. It's saying we know that there's research out there that says people who commit crimes of violence with guns tend to have a prior history of violence, be it a conviction, domestic violence order, something like that. The flaw in logic is the opposite is not true. That is, because you have a prior history of violence, be it a conviction or something similar, that doesn't mean that everybody with that kind of history is going to commit a crime with a violent crime with a gun. And it's the difference between the base rate and the individual, the particular individual. That is a risk assessment where you can say, generally speaking, people with a prior violent history are more likely than people without a prior violent history to engage in violence with a gun. Distinguish that from the two groups in an alternative red flag proposal that is going to be coming before the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee, which I've authored, which identifies two very specific groups who a threat assessment says we need to get guns away, not from the people in that group, but from a particular individual who meets the criteria that are in the statute. Two groups fall into – there are the people who are showing, you know, at least four or five signs of – committing suicide. Mm-hmm. They may be talking about it. They may be clinically depressed. They may they possess or have access to guns. You know, there's got to be four or five factors that tell the research tells us that those people are not a risk of committing suicide with a gun. They're a threat. That individual is a threat. Right. Frighteningly, 60% of all gun deaths in the United States are suicide.
Right. That's something that's been grossly ignored by basically everyone.
Yep. And what's happening when you do that analysis, it's not saying we're going to take guns away from everybody who's at risk of committing suicide. It says in this circumstance with this particular individual, we've seen enough signs ahead of what we think is ahead of time that this person may kill him or herself with a gun that we're going to take the gun away from them mm-hmm. if they meet the requirements of the statute. So that's a threat assessment determination. The other group that we've included in this alternative is the what we're calling mass casualty public shooters. Mm-hmm. Or public mass casualty shooters. Those people who meet a significant number of criteria, the way we've written it now, at least five criteria that are very specific, who if they meet those criteria, they're a threat to where we can likely draw the conclusion that they're a threat to kill a number of people with a gun. Now, those criteria come from a body of research. There's a large body of research about this, but there was a recent FBI study that came out in 2018. There's a Secret Service study that came out two, maybe 3 weeks ago, both of which conclude the same thing. Each of them looked at, in the FBI circumstance, 62 mass casualty shootings, public mass casualty shootings, shootings in public places, places of employment, schools, churches, places like that, town squares. And what are the behaviors that they asked this question, looking at all the police reports in this case, not just reading the media, but getting access to all the police reports and the entire investigation in each of these 62 cases, what pre-attack observable behaviors did we see that are common to these 62? Mm-hmm. And what we've done in the alternative that we've written is we've written those behaviors, we've called those behaviors criteria. And they have to be at least five of them met. There's at least seven, eight, close to nine, maybe nine or ten possibilities, but at least five of them have to be met. And there's very specific definitions. So, you know, it can't be that you just have a hair trigger anger, I suppose, pun intended. it's got to have gotten worse. you know, and it's got to, there's got to be four other things going on. So, again, in that circumstance, when we see that pre-attack behavior that meets those criteria and the judge can conclude that by clear and convincing evidence, it's such good evidence, then we know that person is a threat. No guarantee, but that person's a threat to be a public mass casualty shooter, and we're going to issue a search warrant, an order to for him to turn over his guns or her to turn over their guns, and if they don't, the police can't get a search warrant to go in and seize the guns. So it leaves out from that alternative, focuses only on public mass casualty shooters and suicide by gun shooters. That is, those that we can identify individuals who are a threat rather than operating from a group base rate. You know, more people in this group do this than in other groups, so let's take guns away from everybody in this group.
Right. Which will very quickly have constitutional implications.
Yeah, and that's to the extent that kind of statute ever makes it through a legislature and gets signed by a governor. That's where things are in New Hampshire. It's a controversial topic. It's a really difficult topic. But I think my advice to people as they think about this and read about red flag legislation is think about two things. Does it really drill down on describing a threat assessment tools that judges can use? Number one. Number two, are we talking about suicide by gun, an individual, or a potential public mass casualty shooter? Or are we in that huge group of everybody who's got some sort of violent past? Legislation that focuses on those first two groups, I think, is going to be really constructive, and it addresses the most serious risks that are out there. Legislation that tries to lump them all into one group is a mess. It's going to be ineffective, shouldn't be passed. It's going to have constitutional problems, and I don't know that it will get passed unless the public gets a little carried away.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.